capable of making even a hoary mercenary blush in embarrassment. Surprisingly enough, it worked. The vampire lost his annoying mannerism in the blink of an eye, the conclusion thus being that the most effective defence against intellectual domination is roundly to affront the domineering intellectual. Milva, it seems to me, had been greatly affected by her tragic accident and loss. I write, it seems to me, for I am aware that, being a man, I cannot imagine what such a loss means for a woman. Though I am a poet and a man of the quill, even my educated and trained imagination betrays me here, and I can do nothing. The archer swiftly regained her physical fitness, which could not be said for her mental state. It often happened that she would not utter a word throughout the whole day from dawn to dusk. She would disappear and remain isolated, which worried everyone somewhat, until finally a crisis occurred. Milva released the tension like a dryad or a she-elf, violently, impulsively, and not very comprehensibly. One morning, in front of our eyes, she drew a knife and without a word cut off her plait just above her shoulders. "It doesn't befit me, for I'm not a maiden," she said, seeing our jaws hanging open. "But nor am I a widow," she added, "so that's the end of my mourning." From that moment on, she was her old self, brisk, biting, mouthy, and inclined to use unparliamentary language, from which we happily concluded that she had come through the crisis. The third, and no less curious, member of the company was the Nilfgaardian, who kept trying to prove he was not one. He was called, so he claimed, Caer Mauer Diffrin ap Kielach. Caer Mauer Diffrin, son of Kielach, Dandelion declared, pointing his pencil at the Nilfgaardian. I have reconciled myself with many things which I don't like, and actually can't stand in this honourable company, but not with everything. I can't bear it when people look over my shoulder when I'm writing, and I don't intend to put up with it. The Nilfgaardian moved away from the poet, and after a moment's thought, seized his saddle, sheepskin and blanket, and dragged them over to Milva, who was dozing. I apologise, he said. Forgive my obtrusiveness, Dandelion. I glanced involuntarily out of pure curiosity. I thought you were creating a map or drawing up some tallies. I'm not a bookkeeper, the poet said, losing his temper and standing up. Nor am I a cartographer. But even if I were, it doesn't justify taking a sly look at my notes. I have apologised, Caer repeated dryly, making his bed in the new place. I have reconciled myself with and become accustomed to many things in this honourable company, but I am still accustomed to apologising only once. Indeed, the witcher joined in, totally unexpectedly, for everyone, himself included, taking the side of the young Nilfgaardian. You've become devilishly touchy, Dandelion. I cannot fail to notice that it is somehow connected to the paper which you have recently begun to deface with a bit of lead while we camp. It's true, Rageous agreed, putting more birch branches on the campfire. Our minstrel has become touchy, not to say secretive, discreet and loving of solitude recently. Oh, no, having witnesses when performing his natural needs don't bother him at all, which in our situation one cannot indeed be astonished by. His shameful secrecy and over-sensitivity to being watched extends solely to his scribbled notes. Is perhaps a poem being written in our presence? A rhapsody? An epic? A romance? A canzone? No, Geralt retorted, shifting towards the fire and muffling his back with a blanket. I know him. It can't be a verse because he's not cursing, mumbling or counting the syllables on his fingers. He's writing in silence, so it must be prose. Prose? The vampire flashed his pointed fangs, which he usually tried not to do. A novel, perhaps, or an essay? A morality play? Damn it, Dandelion, don't torture us so, reveal what you are writing. My memoirs. Your what? From these notes, Dandelion displayed a tube stuffed with paper, will arise the work of my life. My memoirs, bearing the title 50 Years of Poetry.
Nonsensical title, Caer declared dryly. Poetry has no age.
And if one concedes that it does, added the vampire, it is decidedly older than that.
You don't understand.
The title means that the author of the work has spent 50 years, no more and no less, in the service of Lady Poetry.
In that case, it's even more nonsensical, said the Witcher. You aren't even 40 yet. Your writing ability was thrashed into you in the Temple Elementary School at the age of 8. Even if we allow that you were writing rhymes in school, you've not been serving Lady Poetry for longer than 30 years. But as I well know, for you've often told me about it, you only began seriously rhyming and composing melodies when you were 19, inspired by your love for Countess de Stael. That makes it the 19th year of your service, Dandelion. So how did you come up with this titular 50 years? Is it meant to be some kind of metaphor?
I, the bard said, puffing up, trace broad horizons with my thought. I describe the present, but I pass into the future. I intend to publish this mighty work in some 20 or 30 years, and then no one will be able to cast doubt on the titular reckoning.
Ha! Now I get it. If anything astonishes me, it's the foresight. You aren't usually bothered about tomorrow.
Tomorrow still doesn't bother me much, the poet declared with superiority. I'm thinking about posterity, about eternity. From the point of view of posterity, Regis observed, it isn't too ethical a beginning to write now in advance. On the basis of the title, posterity has the right to expect a work written from a genuine 50-year perspective, by a person with a genuine 50-year store of knowledge and experience. A person whose experience amounts to half a century, Dandelion interrupted unceremoniously, must be, from the very nature of the case, a 70-year-old decayed old gimmer with his brain eroded by the Hag of Sclerosis. Someone like that should be sitting on the veranda breaking wind, not dictating their memoirs, for people would only laugh. I won't make that error. I'll write my biography at the height of my creative powers. Later, just before publication, I shall merely make cosmetic corrections.
It does have its merits, Geralt said,
as he massaged and cautiously flexed his painful knee.
Particularly for us, for though without doubt we appear in his work, though without doubt he has mould us, in half a century we won't be especially concerned about it.
What's half a century? The vampire smiled. A moment, a fleeting instant. Aha, Dandelion, a minor observation. In my opinion, half a century of poetry sounds better than 50 years. I don't deny it, said the troubadour, crouching over a page and scribbling on it with a pencil. Thanks, Regis. Something constructive at last. Does anyone else have any comments?
I do, Milva began unexpectedly, poking her head out from her blanket.
Why are you goggling at me? Because I'm unlettered. But I'm not stupid. We're on an expedition. We're going to rescue Ciri. We're travelling through enemy lands with sword in hand. This rubbish of Dandelion's might fall into enemy mitts. And we know the poetaster. It's no secret he's a gasbag, a sensation seeker, as well as a gossip. So let him have a care with what he's scrawling, so we don't accidentally get hung because of his scribblings.
You're exaggerating, Milva, the vampire said gently.
Greatly, I'd say, Dandelion continued.
I'd say the same, Kaia added carelessly. I don't know what it's like with the Nordlings, but in the Empire, possession of manuscript isn't considered a crime, nor is literary activity punishable.
Geralt swept his eyes over him and snapped the stick he was playing with.
But libraries are torched in cities captured by that cultured nation, he said in an unaggressive tone, but with a distinct sneer. Never mind, though. Maria, I agree that you're exaggerating. Dandelion's scribblings, as usual, don't have any importance, not regarding our safety.
Oh, sure, said the archer, getting hot under the collar and sitting up. I know what I know. When the royal bailiff were taking a census round our way, my stepfather took to his heels, bolted into the forest, and stayed there for a fortnight without poking his nose out. Wherever there's parchment, there's a judgment, he used to say, and whoever's name is captured in ink today is broke on the wheel tomorrow. And he was right, the rotten bastard. I hope that horse's sizzling in hell.
Milva threw off her blanket, and now, quite wide awake, moved closer to the fire. It looked, Geralt observed, like another long fireside conversation was in the offing.
You weren't fond of your stepfather, I deduce, Dandelion observed, after a moment's silence.
I weren't, Milva said, audibly grinding her teeth, for he were a rotten bastard.
He made advances when Mother wasn't looking, interfered with me. He wouldn't listen, so finally I couldn't stand it no more and took a rake to him. And when he fell over, I gave him a kick or two in the ribs and the privates. 2 days later, he were lying and spitting blood. So, I decided to flee into the world without waiting to see if he got better. Later, I heard rumours he'd died, and Mother soon after him.
Oi, Dandelion, are you writing that down? Don't you dare, hear me?
It was strange that Milva was trekking with us, and the fact that a vampire was accompanying us was astonishing. Nonetheless, strangest, if not simply incomprehensible, were the motives of Kaia, who had suddenly changed from an enemy into, if not a friend, then certainly an ally. The youngster had proved that at the battle on the bridge, unhesitatingly standing with sword in hand beside the Witcher against his countrymen. By this deed, he gained our appreciation and conclusively dispelled our suspicions. In writing our, I have in mind myself, the vampire and the archer, for Geralt, though he had fought shoulder to shoulder with Kaia, though they had looked death in the eye side by side, was still mistrustful of the Nilfgaardian and did not like him. He did admittedly try to hide his resentment, but he was, as I believe I have already mentioned, as simple as a spear shaft, incapable of pretending, and his aversion crept out at every turn, like an eel from a rotten trap. The reason was clear. It was Ciri. It had been my lot to be on the Isle of Thanedd that July new moon, when the bloody battle took place between sorcerers loyal to the kings and traitors incited by Nilfgaard. The traitors were helped by the squirrels, rebellious elves, and Kaia, son of Kyllach. Kaia had been on Thanedd. He had been sent there on a special mission. He was to have seized and abducted Ciri. Ciri wounded him, defending herself. Kaia had a scar on his left hand, at the sight of which my mouth always went dry. It must have been hellishly painful, and he still could not bend two of his fingers. And after all that, we rescued him on the ribbon, when his own countrymen were carrying him away to cruel torture in fetters. Why, I ask, for what misdeeds did they want to execute him? Or was it only for the defeat on Thanedd? Kaia is not garrulous, but I have a sensitive ear, even for monosyllables. The lad is not yet 30, but looks as though he were a high-ranking officer in the Nilfgaardian army. Since he speaks the common speech impeccably, which is seldom found among Nilfgaardians, I think I know what kind of army Kaia served in, and why he was promoted so quickly, and why he was sent on such strange missions, including foreign ones. For Kaia was the man who had tried once before to abduct Ciri, almost 4 years before, during the massacre of Sintra. The destiny guiding the girl's fate had made itself felt for the first time. By coincidence, I talked about this with Geralt on the third day after crossing the Yeruga, 10 days before the equinox, as we were negotiating the forests of Rivadel. That conversation, although very short, was fraught with unpleasant and worrying overtones. And at that moment there was writ on the face and in the eyes of the Witcher a harbinger of the horror which was to explode during the equinox, after we were joined by the fair-haired Angoulême. The Witcher wasn't looking at Dandelion. He wasn't looking ahead. He was looking at Roach's mane.
"Just before her death," he began, "Calanthe forced an oath on several of her knights. They were not to let Ciri fall into Nilfgaardian hands. During the flight, those knights were killed, and Ciri was left alone amidst corpses and conflagration, in the web of streets of the burning city. She would not have got out alive, that is beyond doubt. But he found her, Kaia. He carried her out of the pit of fire and death. He rescued her, heroically. Nobly."
Dandelion reined Pegasus back somewhat. They were riding at the rear, and Regis, Milva, and Kaia were about a quarter of a furlong ahead, but the poet didn't want a single word of their conversation to reach the ears of their companions.
"The problem was," the Witcher continued, "that our Kaia was only acting nobly by order. He was noble as a cormorant is,
He did not swallow the fish because he had a ring on his throat. He was meant to take the fish to his master. He failed, so the master was angry at the cormorant. The cormorant is now out of favour. Is that why he's searching for friendship in the company of fish? What do you think, Dandelion?
The troubadour ducked in the saddle to avoid an overhanging linden branch. The branch already bore completely yellow leaves.
But he saved her life, you said so yourself. Thanks to him, Ciri left Sintra in one piece.
And she cried out in the night, seeing him in her dreams.
But he did save her. Stop dwelling on it, Geralt. Too much has changed. Why, it changes every day. Brooding achieves nothing save distress, which clearly does you no good. He rescued Ciri. That fact was, is, and will remain a fact.
Geralt finally tore his gaze away from the horse's mane and raised his head. Dandelion glanced at his face and swiftly looked away.
The fact remains a fact, the witcher repeated in an angry, metallic voice. Oh, yes, he yelled that fact in my face on Thanet, and his voice stuck in his throat from terror, for he was staring at my sword edge. That fact and that cry were supposed to be the arguments which would stop me murdering him. Well, it did, and I don't think it can now be undone, which is a pity, for a chain ought to have been begun then on Thanet. A long chain of death, a chain of revenge about which tales would still be told after 100 years have passed, tales which people will be afraid to listen to after dark. Do you understand that, Dandelion?
Not really.
Then to hell with you.
That conversation was hideous, and the witcher's expression had been hideous too. Oh, I did not like it when he was in a mood such as that and went off on such attack. I must, though, confess that the vivid comparison with the cormorant had played its role. I began to worry. The fish in its beak, taken to be clubbed, gutted and fried. A truly nice analogy. Joyful prospects.
However, good sense belied such fears. After all, if we were to continue with the fishy metaphors, then who were we? Small fry? Small, bony fry? In exchange for such a meagre haul, the cormorant Kair could not count on imperial grace. In any case, he was far from the pike he wanted to be thought of as. He was small fry just like us. When the war was raking both the earth and people's fates like an iron harrow, who was paying the slightest attention to small fry? I am certain that no one in Nilfgaard remembers Kair now.
Vatier de Rido, chief of the Nilfgaardian military intelligence, listened to the imperial reprimand.
So, Emir Var Emrys continued scathingly, an institution which devours 3 times as much of the state budget as education, culture and the arts taken together is incapable of finding one man. This man simply disappears, goes into hiding, although I spend astronomical sums on an institution from which nothing has any right to remain concealed. One man, guilty of treason, blatantly mocks an institution to which I have given so many privileges and funds as would give even innocent men sleepless nights. Oh, trust me, Vatier, when the council next speaks of trimming the funds for clandestine services, I shall prick up my ears. You may trust that.
Your Imperial Majesty, Vatier de Rido croaked, will make, I have no doubt, the right decision after weighing up all the pros and cons, both the failures and the successes of the intelligence service. Your Majesty may also be certain that the traitor Kair Ep Kialach will not escape punishment. I have taken steps.
I do not pay for your undertakings, but for results. And those are miserable, Vatier, miserable. What about Vilgefortz? Where the hell is Cirilla? What are you mumbling now? Louder!
I think your highness ought to wed the girl we are holding in Dunrowan. We need that marriage. We need the legality of Sintra's foreign fiefdom to subdue the Isles of Skellige and the rebels in Atre, Strept, Magturga, and the Slopes.
We need a general amnesty, peace at the rear and along supply lines. We need the neutrality of Esterad Tyson of Kofir.
I know, but the girl from Don Rowan is not Ciri. I cannot wed her.
May your Imperial Majesty forgive me, but does it matter if she is not authentic? The political situation requires your nuptials, urgently. The bride will be in a veil, and when we finally find the genuine Cirilla, the girls will simply be exchanged.
Have you taken leave of your senses, Vati?
The fake one was only shown briefly at court. No one has seen the real girl in Sintra for 4 years, and rumor has it she spent more time in Skellige than in Sintra. I guarantee that no one will see through the deceit.
No!
Your Imperial...
No, Vatier. Find the real Ciri. Pull your finger out. Find Ciri. Find Kaia and Vilgefortz. Vilgefortz in particular. For he has Ciri. I'm certain of it.
Your Imperial Highness.
Go on, Vatier. Speak.
At one time, I suspected the so-called Vilgefortz case was nothing but a provocation. That the sorcerer had been murdered or is being imprisoned, and the spectacular and clamorous hunt allows Dijkstra to slander us and to justify his brutal repression.
I've had similar suspicions.
Ah, you have? This was not made public in Redania, but my agents informed me that Dijkstra found one of Vilgefortz's hideouts, and within it, evidence of the sorcerer's bestial experiments on people. To be precise, on human fetuses and women with child. If Vilgefortz had Cirilla, I fear that continued searches for her...
Silence, damn it!
On the other hand,
Vatier de Rido quickly added, looking at the Emperor's furious face,
all of that may be disinformation intended to denigrate the sorcerer. That would be Dijkstra's style.
You're paid to find Vilgefortz and take Ciri from him, for God's sake, not to digress and make conjectures. Where is Tawny Owl? Still in Giso? Why? He allegedly left no stone unturned and looked into every hole in the ground. Allegedly, the girl is not there and never was. Apparently, the astrologer was either mistaken or is lying.
Those are all quotations from his reports. What is he still doing there?
Coronor Skellen, I dare observe, undertakes none too transparent measures. He is recruiting for his unit, the one your Highness ordered him to set up in Fort Rocaine, Mecht, where he has established his base. That unit, I take the liberty to add, is an extremely doubtful bunch. But it is odd that, towards the end of August, Lord Skellen hired a notorious assassin.
What?
He engaged a hired thug with instructions to eliminate a criminal gang marauding around Giso. A commendable act, but is it a task for the Imperial Coroner?
Is Invidia speaking through you, Vatier, by any chance? And does it not give your reports color and fervor?
I merely state the facts, Your Highness.
I want... The Emperor stood up abruptly. To see the facts. I'm tired of hearing about them.
It was an extremely hard day.
Vatier de Rido was weary.
In his schedule for that day, he had planned an hour or two of paperwork, intended to protect him from drowning in pending documents, but the thought of it made him shudder.
No, he thought. Easy does it. It can wait. I'm going home.
No, not yet. My wife can wait. I'll go to Cantarella, to my gorgeous Cantarella, with whom I can relax so pleasantly. He quickly made up his mind. He simply rose, took his cloak, and left, a gesture full of disgust, holding off his secretary, who was trying to force a leather portfolio of urgent documents onto him. Tomorrow. Tomorrow is another day. He left the palace by the rear exit, which opened onto the gardens, and walked along a path lined with cypresses. He passed an ornamental pond where a calf, introduced by Emperor Torres, was approaching the venerable age of 132 years, as testified by a golden commemorative medal, attached to the gills of the immense fish.
"Good evening, Viscount."
Vatier released the dagger concealed in his sleeve with a short movement of his forearm. The hilt slid into his hand by itself.
"Very risky, Ryans," he said coldly. "Very risky, showing your burned countenance in Nilfgaard, even as a magical teleprojection."
"You noticed?" "And Vilgefortz assured me that if you didn't touch me, you wouldn't guess it was an illusion."
Vatier put the dagger away. He had not guessed it was an illusion at all, but now he knew.
"You are too great a coward, Ryans," he said, "to show yourself here in person. You know what would befall you if you did."
"Is the Emperor still so determined to seize me, and my master, Vilgefortz?"
"Your insolence is disarming." "Go to hell, Vatier. We're still on your side, Vilgefortz and I. Well, I admit we tricked you with the counterfeit Cyrilla, but it was done in good faith. In good faith, may I be drowned if I lie. Vilgefortz believed that since the real one had vanished, a fake one was better than none at all. We reckoned it was all the same to you."
"Your insolence has stopped being disarming and has begun to be insulting. I have no intention of wasting time talking to an insulting mirage. When I finally get my hands on you, we shall have a conversation, a long conversation. So until that time, apage, Ryans."
"What's come over you, Vatier? In the past, if even the devil himself appeared to you, you wouldn't forget to investigate, before the exorcism, if you couldn't by any chance profit in some way."
Vatier did not grace the illusion with a glance. Instead, he watched the algae-covered carp idly churning up the sludge in the pond.
"Profit in some way?"
he repeated slowly, pouting his lips contemptuously.
"From you? And what could you give me? The real Cyrilla, perhaps? Perhaps your patron, Vilgefortz? Perhaps Kair ap Kialach?
Hold hard."
Ryans raised an illusory hand.
"You mentioned him."
"Who?"
"Kair. We shall bring you Kair's head, I and my master Vilgefortz."
"Have mercy, Ryans," Vatier snorted. "Reverse the order."
"As you wish. Vilgefortz, with my humble help, will give you the head of Kair, son of Kialach. We know where he is, and can pluck him out like a lobster from a pot, if you wish."
"So, you have such capabilities. Well, well. Such good stool pigeons in Queen Maeve's army."
"Are you testing me?"
Ryan grimaced.
"You really don't know."
"Must be the latter.
Kair, my dear Viscount, is...
We know where he is. We know where he's headed, and in what company. You want his head? You shall have it."
"A head?" Vatier smiled. "Which won't be able to tell anyone what really happened on Thanet."
"That's probably for the best," said Ryan cynically. "Why give Kair the chance to talk? Our task is to ease, not exacerbate, the animosity between Vilgefortz and the Emperor. I shall bring you the mute head of Kair ap Kialach. We'll do it in such a way that it looks like your, and only your, achievement. Delivery in the next 3 weeks?"
The ancient carp in the fish pond fanned the water with its pectoral fins. That beast, thought Vatier, must be very wise. But why does it need that wisdom? It's still the same sludge in the same water lilies.
"Your price, Ryans?"
"A trifle. Where is Stefan Schelen, and what is he plotting?"
"I told him what he wanted to know."
Vatier de Rido stretched out on the pillows, playing with a ringlet of Cartier van Kanten's golden hair.
"You see, my sweet, one has to approach some matters wisely, and to approach them wisely means to conform. If one behaves differently, one won't get anything. Just the putrid water and foul-smelling sludge in the fish pond. And so what if the pond is made of marble and is 3 paces from the palace? Aren't I right, my sweet?"
Cartier van Kanten, known by the pet name of Cantarella, did not answer. Vatier in no way expected an answer. The girl was 18 and, to put it mildly, no genius. Her interests, at least for the moment, were limited to making love with, at least for the moment, Vattier. Cantarella was a natural talent in sexual matters, combining enthusiasm and wholeheartedness with technique and artistry. That was not the most important thing about her, though. Cantarella spoke little and seldom, while listening willingly and splendidly. With Cantarella, one could unload oneself, relax, spiritually unwind, and psychologically regenerate oneself.
A man in this service can expect nothing but reprimands, Vattier said bitterly, just because he hasn't found some Cyrilla or other. And is the fact that, thanks to the work of my men, the army is achieving successes unimportant? Does the fact that the general staff knows the enemy's every move mean nothing? And how many strongholds have my agents opened for the Imperial forces, which would have taken weeks to storm? But no, there is no praise for that. Only some Cyrilla or other is important.
Puffing up angrily, Vattier de Rido took a glass of excellent Est of Toussaint from Cantarella's hands, a wine with a vintage that remembered the days when Emperor Emiavar Emrys was a cruelly damaged little boy, devoid of any rights to the throne, and Vattier de Rido was a young officer of the intelligence service, insignificant in the hierarchy. It had been a good year for wine. Vattier sipped it, played with Cantarella's shapely breasts, and went on. Cantarella listened splendidly.
"Stefan Skellen, my sweet," muttered the chief of the Imperial Intelligence Service, "is a wheeler, dealer, and a conspirator. But I shall know what he's up to before Ryons gets there. I already have an agent there. Very close to Skellen. Very close."
Cantarella untied the sash fastening Vattier's dressing gown and leaned forward. Vattier felt her breath and moaned in anticipation of the pleasure.
"That's talent," he thought.
And then the soft, hot touch of velvety lips drove all thoughts from his head. Cartier van Canten, slowly, deftly and skillfully, supplied Vattier de Rido, the chief of the Imperial Intelligence Service, with sexual bliss. That wasn't Cartier's only talent, but Vattier de Rido had no idea about her others. He didn't know that, despite appearances, Cartier van Canten possessed a splendid memory and intelligence as lively as quicksilver. Everything Vattier told her, every piece of information, every word he uttered, Cartier passed on to the sorceress Azire Varanahid the next day.
"Yes, I would stake my head that everyone in Nilfgaard forgot about Kaia long ago, including his betrothed, if he had one. But more about that later, for now we return to the day and place the Yeruga was crossed. We rode quite briskly eastwards, meaning to reach the region of the Black Forest known in the Elder Speech as Caed Du, for there dwelt the Druids, who were capable of divining where Ciri was residing, or foretelling her location from the weird dreams that were vexing Geralt. We rode through Upper Rivendell, also known as Left Bank, a wild and deserted land situated between the Yeruga and the slopes set at the foot of the Amel Mountains, delineated to the east by the Dol Angra Valley, and to the west by a boggy lakeland whose name has slipped my mind. No one laid any specific claim to that land, and so it was never rightly known to whom it actually belonged or who governed it. In that respect, it seems, the successive monarchs of Temeria, Sodden, Sintra, and Rivia, who, with varying results, treated Left Bank as a fiefdom of their kingdoms, and occasionally tried to drive home their arguments using fire and sword, had some say. And, subsequently, the Nilfgaardian army arrived from beyond the Amel Mountains, and no one had anything more to say, or any doubts about issues of fiefdom or territorial rights. Everything south of the Yeruga belonged to the Empire. As I write these words, plenty of lands to the north also belong to the Empire. Owing to a lack of precise information, I do not know how many or how far to the north.
Going back to Riverdale, permit me, dear reader, a digression concerning historical processes. The history of a given territory is often created and formed by accident, as a side effect of the conflicts between external forces. A given land's history is very often created by foreigners. Foreigners are the cause, but the effects are always invariably borne by the local people. That rule fully applied to Riverdale. Riverdale had its own folk, indigenous Riverdellers. The unceasing years of scrambles and struggles had transformed them into beggars and forced them to migrate. Their villages and settlements had gone up in smoke, and the ruins of homesteads and fields were transformed into fallow land and swallowed up by the wilderness. Trade fell into decline, and caravans avoided the neglected roads and tracks. The few Riverdellers who remained turned into coarse boors. They mainly differed from wolverines and bears by the fact that they wore breeches. At least some of them did. I mean, some of them wore breeches, and some of them differed from the beasts. They were, generally speaking, an unobliging, crude, and boorish nation, and utterly devoid of a sense of humour. The dark-haired daughter of the forest beekeeper tossed her plait over her shoulder and resumed turning the quern with furious vigour. Dandelion's efforts were in vain. The poet's words seemed not to register with their audience. Dandelion winked at the rest of the company, pretending to sigh and raise his eyes to the ceiling. But he did not quit. "Let me," he repeated, grinning. "Let me grind while you fetch some ale from the cellar. There must be a hidden cellar somewhere around here, and a keg in the vault. Am I right, fair one?" "You might leave the wench alone, my lord," the forest beekeeper's wife, a tall, willowy woman of astonishing beauty, said crossly as she busied herself around the kitchen. "I already told thee, there ain't no ale here." "You've been told near a dozen times, my lord," the forest beekeeper said, backing up his wife, breaking off from his conversation with the witcher and the vampire. "I shall make you pancakes with honey, and then you'll eat. But leave the wench in peace to grind the corn for meal, for without meal even a sorcerer cannot make a pancake. Let her be. Let her grind in peace." "Did you hear that, Dandelion?" called the witcher. "Leave the girl alone, and go and do something useful. All right, your memoirs." "I fancy a drink. I fancy a drink before eating. I have some herbs. I'll brew myself an infusion. Granny, would there be any hot water in this cottage?" "Hot water, I'm asking. Would there be any?" An old woman, the forest beekeeper's mother, sitting on the stove bench, raised her head from the sock she was darning. "There would, Petal, there would," she muttered. "Only it'd be cold, but no." Dandelion groaned and sat down, resigned, at the table, where the company was chatting with the beekeeper, whom they had happened upon in the forest early that morning. The beekeeper was short, thick-set, swarthy, and terribly hairy. No wonder, then, that he had given the company a scare when he loomed out of the undergrowth unexpectedly. They had taken him for a lycanthrope. To make it funnier still, the first to yell, "Werewolf! Werewolf!" had been the vampire Regis. There was something of a commotion, but the matter was quickly cleared up, and the beekeeper, though at first sight surly, turned out to be hospitable and courteous. The company accepted the invitation to his homestead. His homestead, called in forest beekeeping jargon a shanty, stood in a cleared glade where the beekeeper, his mother, his wife, and their daughter lived. The latter two were women of exceptional, though somewhat curious, looks, clearly indicating that there was a dryad or hamadryad among their forebears. During the conversations that ensued, the forest beekeeper at first gave the impression one could talk to him solely about bees. Beehives carved into trees, hollows, rope harnesses, bear fences, beeswax, honey and honey gathering. But that was just a semblance. "With politics, and what should be happening with it? Same as usual. We have to pay more and more duty. 3 urns of honey and an entire length of wax. I can barely supply it. I sit in my ropes from dawn to dusk, gouging out hollows. Who do I pay the duty to? To whoever calls. How am I to know who's in power now? Some time since, you know, they've been speaking Nilfgaardian. I hear we're now an Imperial Provenance, or something like that. They pay for the honey, if I sell any, in Imperial coin, with the Emperor's head stuck on it.
His mush is more comely, though cruel. You'll know him right away, if you get my drift.
Two dogs, one black and the other ruddy, sat facing the vampire, raised their heads and started to howl. The beekeeper's hamadryad wife turned back from the hearth and hit them with her broom.
"That'd be an evil sign," the beekeeper said, "when hounds howl in broad daylight. Kind of thing... What was I supposed to be talking about?"
"About the druids of Kaidu."
"Eh? So you wasn't jesting, my lord. You rightly mean to go to the druids? Sick of life, are you? That way is death. He who dares to venture into the mistletoe's clearings is seized, shoved into a wicker doll and roasted over a slow flame."
Geralt looked at Regis, and Regis winked at him. They both knew the popular rumours about the druids, and every last one was fabricated. Milva and Dandelion, though, began listening with greater curiosity than before, and evident alarm.
"There's some as say," the forest beekeeper continued, "that the mistletoers are getting their own back, for the Nilfgaardians vexed them first by entering their holy oak groves down in Dol Angrar, and by walloping the druids for no reason. Others say the druids started it, capturing and tormenting a couple of imporial men to death, and now Nilfgaard are getting their revenge. How it rightly is, no one knows. But one thing brooks no doubt. The druids catch people, puts them in the wicker woman and burns them. To venture among them is certain death."
"We are not afraid," Geralt said calmly.
"Certainly."
The forest beekeeper eyed the witcher, Milva and Kair up and down. Kair was just entering the cottage, having groomed the horses.
"It is evident you are fearless folk, valorous and armed. Eh? Wouldn't be no fear journeying with the likes of you, you know. But the mistletoers ain't in the Black Grove presently. Your toils and travels would be in vain. Nilfgaard pressed them, drove them from Kaidu. They ain't there presently."
"How so?"
"Thus it is. The mistletoers have fled."
"Fled where?"
The forest beekeeper glanced at his hamadryad wife and said nothing for a moment.
"Fled where?"
the witcher repeated. The beekeeper's tabby cat sat down before the vampire and meowed frightfully. The hamadryad hit it with her broom.
"It be an evil sign when a tomcat mews in broad daylight," the beekeeper mumbled, strangely embarrassed. "But the druids, you know, boy, they fled for the slopes. Right enough, I speak the truth, to the slopes."
"A good 60 miles south,"
Dandelion estimated, in quite a casual, even cheerful voice. But he fell silent when he saw the witch's expression. Only the ominous meowing of the cat, promptly driven outside, could be heard in the silence that fell.
"Well," the vampire began, "what difference does it make to us?"
The next morning brought more surprises, and riddles which were quickly solved.
"A pox on it,"
said Milva, who was the first to scramble out of the hay barrack, awoken by the commotion.
"Well, I'll be blowed. Look at that, Geralt."
The clearing was full of people. At first glance, it could be seen that 5 or 6 forest beekeeping families were gathered there. The witcher's trained eye also picked out several fur trappers and at least one tar maker. Taken together, there were 12 men, 10 women, 10 adolescents of both sexes, and the same number of little children. The gathering was equipped with 6 wagons, 12 oxen, 10 cows and 4 goats, a fair number of sheep, and also plenty of dogs and cats, whose barking and meowing could definitely be considered a bad omen in such circumstances.
"I wonder," Kair said, rubbing his eyes, "what this means."
"Trouble,"
Dandelion replied, shaking the hay from his hair. Regis said nothing, but wore a curious expression.
"Please, break your fast, noble lords," said their friend, the forest beekeeper,
approaching the rick, accompanied by a broad-shouldered man.
"Breakfast is ready, milky porridge and honey. And if I may introduce Jan Cronin, headman of us forest beekeepers."
"Pleased to meet you,"
the witcher lied, without returning the bow, partly because his knee was paining him intensely.
"And this crowd, how did they get here?"
"Type of thing,"
the beekeeper scratched the back of his head.
"As you see, winter's coming. The trees have bare fences. The hollows have been gouged out. Time we return to the slopes and read Brunner. Store away the honey for winter, you know. But it is perilous to be in the forests, alone.
The headman cleared his throat. The beekeeper glanced at Geralt's face and seemed to shrink a little.
You were mounted and armed, he grunted. Valorous and bold. Anyone can see it. Wouldn't be no fear travelling with the likes of you. And it would be commodious for you. We know every path, every track, every copse and hole, and we can feed you.
And the druids, Gaia said coldly, have left Kaidu and headed for the slopes, where you want to go. What a remarkable coincidence.
Geralt walked slowly over to the forest beekeeper and grabbed him by the front of his coat, but a moment later thought better of it, released him and smoothed down his garments. He said nothing and asked nothing. But in any case, the beekeeper hurried to explain.
I spoke the truth, I swear. May the earth swallow me up if I lie. The mistletoers have gone from Kaidu. They ain't there.
And they're in the slopes, are they? Geralt growled. Where you are headed, you and this rabble of yours. And you want to travel with an armed escort? Speak, fellow, but take heed. The earth is indeed liable to cleave open.
The beekeeper lowered his eyes and looked down apprehensively at the ground beneath his feet. Geralt kept meaningfully silent. Milva, finally understanding what it was all about, cursed foully. Gaia snorted contemptuously.
Well, the witch urged, where were the druids making for?
Who knows, my lord,
the beekeeper finally mumbled.
But they may be in the slopes. Just as well as they might be anywhere else. There's a plenitude of mighty oak groves in the slopes, and druids are fond of oaks.
Aside from Headman Cronin, both Hamadryads, mother and daughter, were now standing behind the beekeeper. It's fortunate the daughter takes after her mother and not her father, the witcher thought, for the beekeeper suits his wife as well as a wild boar suits a mare. He noticed that several more women were standing behind the Hamadryads. They were much less comely, but were looking at him just as pleadingly. He glanced at Regis, not knowing whether to laugh or curse. The vampire shrugged.
Let me start by saying, he said, that the forest beekeeper is right, Geralt. It is quite probable that the druids have gone to the slopes. It is perfectly fitting terrain for them.
Is that probability?
The witcher's gaze was very, very cold.
Sufficiently great, in your view, to prompt us to abruptly change our course and head off blindly with these folk here.
Regis shrugged again.
What difference does it make? Think it over. The druids are not in Kaidu, so we ought to eliminate that direction of travel. Neither can a return to the Yaruga, I adventure, be an option. And so all remaining directions are equally good.
Really?
The temperature of the witcher's voice now equaled his gaze.
And which of those that remain, in your view, would be most advisable? The one with the forest beekeepers, or a quite different one? Will you, in your infinite wisdom, undertake to stipulate that?
The vampire turned slowly towards the forest beekeeper. The forest beekeeper, headman, the Hamadryads, and the other women.
What is it, he asked gravely, you fear so much, good folk, that you seek an escort? What arouses this fear in you? Speak plainly.
Oh, my lord,
Jan Cronin whined, and the most genuine horror appeared in his eyes.
I'm glad you asked. Our way goes through the dank wilderness. And it's ghastly there, my lord. There are, my lord, Bracolacs, Vampirodes, Endurags, Gryphoons, and all kind of monstrosities. Why, barely 2 Sundays since, a leshy snatched my son-in-law. He only managed a rasp, and that was him, dead. Do you not wonder that we're afeard to go that way with our women and bairns, eh?
The vampire glanced at the witcher, and his face was very grave.
My boundless wisdom, he said,
suggests I stipulate that the most advisable direction is whichever is most advisable for the Witcher. We set off northwards, towards the slopes, a land lying at the foot of the Amel Mountains. We set off in a great procession which contained everything. Young women, forest beekeepers, fur trappers, women, children, young women, domestic livestock, household paraphernalia, and young women. And a hell of a lot of honey. Everything was sticky from the honey, even the girls. The train moved at walking and wagon speed, but the pace of the march did not falter, for we did not stray, but marched with ease. The beekeepers knew the tracks, paths, and causeways between the lakes. But that knowledge came in useful. Oh, how it did, for it began to drizzle, and suddenly the whole of bloody Riverdale was plunged into a fog as thick as cream. Without the beekeepers, we would surely have lost our way or sunk somewhere in the mire. Neither did we have to waste time or energy organizing and preparing victuals. We were fed thrice a day, amply, if simply, and were permitted to laze around for some time after each repast. In short, it was wonderful. Even the Witcher, that old sourpuss and bore, began to smile and enjoy life more, for he reckoned we were covering 15 miles a day, which we had never once managed since leaving Brokilon. The Witcher had no work, for though the dank wilderness was so dank it would have been difficult to imagine anything danker, we did not encounter any monsters. Sure, at night, spectres howled a little, forest weepers moaned and will-o'-the-wisps capered on the bogs, but nothing remarkable. It was a tiny bit worrying, in truth, that once again we were travelling in quite an accidentally chosen direction, and once again without a precisely defined destination. But, as the vampire rages articulated, it is better to go forward without an aim than loiter without an aim, and with surety, much better than to retreat without an aim.
Dandelion, strap that tube of yours on securely. It would be a shame for half a century of poetry to break free and get lost in the ferns.
No fear, I shan't lose it, be certain of it, nor let anyone take it from me. Anyone wanting this tube will have to wrest it from my cooling corpse. Might one know, Geralt, what provokes your peals of laughter? Let me hazard a guess. Congenital imbecility? It so happened that a team of archaeologists from the University of Castel Grappion, conducting excavations in Beauclair, dug through a layer of charcoal, indicating a great fire, to an even older layer, estimated to date from the 13th century. In that layer, a cavern formed by the remains of walls and sealed by clay and lime was excavated, and in it, to the great excitement of the scholars, were two perfectly preserved human skeletons, those of a woman and a man. Beside the skeletons, apart from weapons and countless small artifacts, was a tube made of hardened leather and measuring 2.5 feet long. A coat of arms with faded colours depicting lions and lozenges was embossed on the leather. Professor Schliemann, a distinguished specialist in the sigillography of the Dark Ages, who was leading the team, identified the coat of arms as the emblem of Rivia, an ancient kingdom of unconfirmed location. The archaeologists' excitement reached its peak, since manuscripts were kept in similar tubes in the Dark Ages, when the container's weight permitted the supposition that there was plenty of paper or parchment preserved inside. The tube's excellent condition offered hope that the documents would be legible and throw light on the shadowy past. The centuries were about to speak. It was an exceptional surprise, a victory of science which could not be squandered. Linguists and scholars of extinct languages were prudently summoned from Castel Grappion, along with specialists capable of opening the tube without the risk of even the slightest damage to the valuable contents. Meanwhile, rumours of treasure had spread through Professor Schliemann's team. It so happens that those words reached the ears of three characters known as Zdeib, Billy Goat, and Camille Ronstetter, who'd been hired to dig out the clay. Convinced that the tube was literally stuffed full of gold and valuables, the three aforementioned diggers, under cover of darkness, swiped the priceless artifact
and fled with it to the forest. Once there, they lit a small fire and sat down around it.
"What are you waiting for?" Billy Goat said to Zdibe. "Open up that pipe."
"Won't give,"
Zdibe complained to Billy Goat.
"It's as tight as a horse, son."
"Stand on the sodding bitch," Kamel Ronstetter advised.
The husp of the priceless find gave way under Zdibe's heel, and the contents fell out onto the ground.
"Bargain a sodding bitch," Billy Goat yelled in astonishment. "What is it?"
The question was foolish, for at first sight it could be seen they were sheets of paper, for which reason Zdibe, rather than answer, took one of the sheets and brought it up to his nose. He examined the curious-looking signs for a long while.
"It's writing," he finally stated authoritatively. "They're letters."
"Letters?"
Kamil Ronstetter roared, paling in horror.
"Written letters? What a bitch."
"Writing? Meaning spells?"
Billy Goat jabbered, his teeth chattering in terror.
"Letters? Meaning witchery? Don't touch it, son of a sodding bitch. You might catch something from it."
Zdibe didn't need telling twice, throwing the page onto the fire and nervously wiping his trembling hands on his breeches. Kamil Ronstetter kicked the rest of the papers into the campfire. After all, children might chance upon that foul stuff. Then the three hurried away from that dangerous place. The priceless writing from the Dark Ages burned with a tall, bright flame. For a few short moments, the centuries spoke with a soft whisper of paper blackening in the fire. And then the flame went out, and darkness covered the earth. Hufvenagel, Dominic Bombastus, born 1239, became rich in Ebbing, conducting trade on a great scale, and settled in Nilfgaard. Respected by previous emperors, he was appointed Burgrave and Director of Mines in Venendal by Emperor Jan Kalvit, and, as reward for services rendered, was given the office of Mayor of Navoingen. A faithful imperial advisor, Hufvenagel had the emperor's favour and also participated in many public affairs. Died 1301. While still in Ebbing, Hufvenagel was engaged in numerous charitable works, supported the needy and impoverished, and founded orphanages, hospitals and nurseries, putting up plentiful sums for them. A great enthusiast of the fine arts and sport, he founded a comedic theatre and stadium in the capital, both of which bore his name. He was regarded as a model of probity, honesty, and mercantile decency. Effenberg and Talbot, Encyclopaedia Maxima Mundi, Volume 7. Chapter 4.
Witnesses' surname and given name.
Selborne Kenner. I meant Joanna.
Profession?
Provider of diverse services.
Is the witness jesting? May the witness be reminded that she stands before the Imperial Tribunal in a trial of high treason. The lives of many people depend on the witness's testimony, since the penalty for treason is death. May the witness be reminded that she stands before the tribunal by no means as a free agent, but having been brought from a place of isolation in the citadel, and whether the witness returns there or is discharged depends, inter alia, on her testimony. The tribunal has taken the liberty of this lengthy lecture in order to show the witness how highly improper buffoonery and facetiae are in this chamber. They are not merely unpalatable, but also threaten very grave consequences. The witness has a half-minute to ponder this matter, after which the tribunal shall pose the question once again.
Very well, illustrious judge.
Address us as Your Honour. Witness's profession.
I'm a psionic, Your Honour, but mainly in the service of the Imperial Intelligence.
Please keep your answers brief and to the point. Should the court be desirous of further explanations, we shall ask for them. The court is aware of the collaboration between the witness and the Empire's secret service. For the record, what is the meaning of the term psionic, which the witness used when giving her profession?
I've got pure HSP, which means first category psi, without the gift of PK. To be precise, I can hear other people's thoughts and speak remotely with a sorcerer, elf or other psionic, and I can give orders using thought. Make someone do what I want them to. I can also do precog, but only when I'm under.
Please enter in the proceedings that the witness, Johanna Selborn, is a psionic with the gift of hypersensory perception. She is a telepath and tele-empath, able to carry out precognition under hypnosis, but without the ability of psychokinesis. The witness is admonished that the use of magic and extrasensory powers in this chamber is strictly prohibited. We shall continue the hearing. When, where, and in what circumstances did the witness encounter the matter of the person passing herself off as Cyrilla, Princess of Sintra?
I only found out about some Cyrilla or other when I was in the Clink. I mean, in a place of isolation, illustrious tribunal. While being investigated, I was made aware it was the same person as had been called Falker or the Sintran in my hearing. And the circumstances were such that I must state the order of events. For clarity, I mean. It was like this. I was accosted in a tavern in Aetolia by Dacre Silophan, him, who's sitting over there.
Make note that the witness, Johanna Selborn, has indicated the accused Silophant without being prompted. Please continue.
Dacre, illustrious tribunal, recruited a Hansa, an armed troop, valiant to a man and woman. Defeats Creel, Niratin Taker, Chloe Stitz, Andres Vierney, Till Ikrada. Well, they're all dead, Your Honour. And of the ones what survived, most of them are sitting here, under guard.
Please state precisely when the meeting of the witness and the accused Silophant took place.
It was last year, in the month of August, somewhere near the end, I don't recall exactly. Well, not in September, in any case, for that September is well embedded in my memory. Dacre, who'd learned about me from somewhere, said the Hansa needed a psionic, one that wasn't afraid of magic, because we'd be dealing with sorcerers. The work, he said, was for the Emperor and the Empire, well paid, furthermore, and the Hansa would be commanded by none other than Tawny Owl himself.
When they say Tawny Owl, does the witness have in mind Stefan Skellen, the Imperial Coroner?
Yes, I do. Indeed, I do.
Please enter that in the proceedings. When and where did the witness encounter Coroner Skellen?
It was in September, on the 14th, in Fort Rocaine. Rocaine, illustrious tribunal, is aboard a watchtower, which guards the trade route from Mecht to Ebbing, Giso and Metina. Our Hansa, numbering some 15 horse, was brought there by Dacre Silophan. So, taken together, there were 22 of us, as the others were already standing by in Rocaine, under the command of Ola Harsheim and Bert Brigden.
The wooden floor boomed beneath heavy boots. Spurs jingled and metal buckles clinked.
"Greetings, Sir Stefan."
Tawny Owl not only did not stand up, he didn't even take his feet from the table. He just waved a hand in a very lordly gesture.
"At last," he said curtly, "you've kept me waiting a long time, Silophant."
"A long time?"
Dacre Silophant laughed.
"That's rich, Sir Stefan. You gave me 4 Sundays to gather and bring here a good dozen of the best blades the Empire and its dominions have produced. A year would be too little for the assembling of such a Hansa, but I tossed it off in 22 days. That deserves praise, eh?"
"Let's refrain from praise," Skellen said coolly, "until I've seen this Hansa of yours."
"Why not now? Here are my, and now your, Sir Stefan, lieutenants, Naratan Saker and Dufizi Creel."
"Hail, hail."
Tawny Owl finally decided to stand up, and his adjutants also rose.
"Let me introduce you, gentlemen. Bert Brigden, Ola Harsheim."
"We know each other well."
Dacre Silophant grasped Ola Harsheim's right hand firmly.
"We put down the rebellion in Nazaire under old Braben. That was comical, eh, Ola? Eh, comical? The horses were hocked deep in blood. And Mr. Brigden, if I'm not mistaken, from Gemera? From the pacifiers? There'll be comrades in the squad. I've got a few pacifiers there."
"I'm getting impatient to see them,"
Tawny Owl interjected.
"May we go?"
A moment,
Dacre said.
"Naratin, go and array the company so they look their best before the Honourable Coroner."
Is it a he or a she, that Naratin Cheka? Tony Owl squinted, watching the officer leave. A woman or a man?
Mr. Skellen?
Dacre Siliphant cleared his throat, but when he spoke, his voice was steady and his eyes cold.
I do not know, exactly. He would appear to be a man, but I'm not certain. As to what kind of officer Naratin Seeker is, I'm certain. What you have deigned to ask me about would be significant were I to ask him, or her, for his or her hand. But that I do not intend. Neither do you, I expect.
You are right, Skellen conceded after a moment's thought. So, there's nothing to say. Let's go and scrutinize your gang, Siliphant. Naratin Seeker, the individual of uncertain gender, had not wasted time. When Skellen and the officers went out into the fort's courtyard, the squad was standing in tidy array, aligned so that not a horse's muzzle extended further than a span.